30 months later, we were at $910 million. At 27 years old, I went from having no money to sales of $3.2 million. It was life-changing. In my mind, we were either growing or we would fail. I talked the Houston Chronicle into get rid of those trucks and then outsourcing the work to me. Exxon Company USA, they had like 2,200 vendors in Houston that they bought from. I talked to Exxon and convinced them to consolidate that into one company, mine. We created Coach USA, Homes USA, Metals USA. And so I took on that responsibility and bought, I think the number was 73 companies in about 30 months. And we boosted our revenues from, I think we were about $100 million when we went public. And then 30 months later, we were at $910 million. I think the most creative thing I've done is to invent the way frac sand is delivered downhole. Between Josh and I, we had like 65 patents, and we completely disrupted the frac sand supply chain. You do not know anything about technology. I was so arrogant in my thinking that, you know, I can do this too. We've raised a pretty good amount of money, and we've blown through it all. I just thought it was always uphill, right? I mean, the line was going up, right?
That's right.
And it went down, but what I had, the saving grace was...
All right, Hustle Fam, we are back with another amazing episode. We are here recording live from Las Vegas, Nevada. We are at the CLDA FMF 24. I have the distinct pleasure of sitting with Mr. John Oren. He is an investor in multiple final mile businesses, everything from actual logistics, operations to tech. I've heard a ton about you. I just want to learn about, you know, kind of what you're working on, kind of how you've built your businesses and so forth. But first of all, I have to thank you for coming on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Well, you're more than welcome. You know, we'll try and keep this interesting and not quite boring. You know, because
that's what it's all about. Business is boring, but it's also interesting at times, right? We can make it interesting.
Well, I think business, particularly in the transportation logistics space, is probably most exciting time that I've ever, and I've been in it for a long time, but it's probably the most exciting time right now.
That's right. So you've been in business since 1977?
Yes, I did.
77, and you were in the first mile, the last mile logistics space from the origin, from the beginning.
Well, so I look at it as same day express delivery, which is different from, you know, people get confused about this industry because they go, oh, you guys are like UPS. And I was like, no, we're not like you. Oh, well, then FedEx maybe. So I like to say it this way, you know, FedEx is next day, UPS is second day, United States Postal Service is someday. and we are in the same day. We pick it up today, we deliver it today. So we're very, very quick in our pickup and delivery process. And so, and this industry sort of, you know, operates under the radar screen, you know, of in the transportation logistics space, you know, because people are saying like, oh, are you the messenger guys? Or are you the, you know, what guys are you? So it, you know, but we're a big industry, chock full, probably 7,000 to 7,500 business owners across North America in this space, and we provide a very important a service to the country and to industry.
Yeah, I love that. In 77, what did the industry look like?
Well, it was a lot smarter, smaller. You know, it was very difficult to size the industry. That was a challenge because the industry highly fragmented, entrepreneurial driven. Dominated by mom and pops. And so when I took my company public, I started in 77. I took it public on the New York Stock Exchange in 1994. And okay. one of the things I had to do was to size the industry. It was very difficult to get a number around it, but we sized the industry somewhere around $3 billion or something like that. That's 1994. 77, it was somewhat smaller. I guess you could kind of extrapolate some CAGR number to it, but it has definitely probably tripled in size, if not quadrupled in size. And pre-COVID and post-COVID, which has pulled the industry forward by, I think, by accelerated by at least 10 years, it's an expanding business, particularly when you add the final mile element. So prior to COVID, this final mile idea, that is delivering it from a warehouse or distribution center into the home, was part of our industry we did not do. There were specialized carriers that did that. But e-commerce and COVID has pulled us forward. So, you know, this industry, where we had a reduction of revenues because of technology, the fax machine, and now we have, you know, all kinds of apps that you can you don't need to hand carry an envelope. You can digitize it and send it. So we had a shrinking industry, and then we have had now an expanding industry. Technology began to shrink it. Technology also now has helped us expand this industry, and particularly final mile or home delivery to the home is a big business, and it's going to be, I think, a 20% plus and a compounded annual growth rate over time. So this industry, same day express industry, has embraced it, and we're trying to figure it out and trying to, you know, execute you know, in greater standards of service, you know, since COVID broke on us.
Got it. What made you get into the industry?
In 77,
initially, like, what was your origin story? Like, was it something that you just fell upon, or was it something that your father did? Like, tell me about that.
No, it's not what my father was. He was a pastor.
Okay. And, so man of the cloth.
He was a delivery service of a different kind, I suppose. You know, so. But I got married at 18, and my wife and I, we fell in love and got married right out of high school. And, you know, she went to business college to help support me as I went through college, and I went through college. My entire goal was to be a teacher, actually, a high school teacher. And that was what I wanted to do, and that's what I got educated for. But I was distracted from that very rapidly. I was getting my degree. I got a job offer. And it from a large cement manufacturer where I had worked summertime jobs. It paid double what a teacher would be paid, and so I accepted that, and so I took a hard right turn into industry. That cement plant in Houston moved out to the country then because it was too polluting in the city of Houston, where it was really nestled right up against downtown. So they moved the plant. I didn't want to move with it. And so I found a job with a man who owned several delivery services. He was a very innovative entrepreneur. And so he wanted to teach young men and women how to operate a delivery service. And so he trained me and put me through a training program. And then he said, go to the east side of Houston and start a delivery business. And so I did. I thought it was a good idea to franchise that idea, and I talked to him about it, and he said, well, why don't you just buy it from me? So, you know, through a process, a difficult process, because I had no money, took about a year to get things figured out, and the help of that gentleman that I worked for, he helped finance it, and I took the little fledgling delivery service that I'd started, and I bought it on my own, my wife and I, and then we, you know, started out with two trucks and built our little business, you know, over time based in Houston. And we had some very early success. I attribute that to just, you know, getting up in the morning and going to work every day and, you know, grappling with all the things that you need to do. But primarily my job was to grow the business, go out and sell our services.
Yeah.
Which is what I did.
And what was your service at that time?
We were doing on-demand deliveries, routed deliveries, scheduled deliveries, you know, the typical three things that this industry was founded on. On-demand, routed, and scheduled.
What type of commodities?
Well, on the east side of Houston, this was the manufacturing side of Houston. So heavy industry, you know, that was tilted towards the oil and gas industry, like Hughes Tool, Baker Packers, Reed Rockbit, Dresser, and so many other manufacturers of equipment that's being used in the oil patch were my customers. Those were the people that I called on. And so, you know, like Reed Rockbit, great customer, early on win for me. You know, they were shipping maybe 50 rock bits out every day all over the world, and we'd pick it up at their manufacturing facility, and we'd take it either to the bus line or we'd take it to it and put it on the next flight out. They were a great customer. Baker Packers, great customer. Hughes Tool, all these oil and gas companies, which are still around today, are our customers and still our customers today.
Wow. You said you started with two trucks, and mm-hmm. how were you able to grow that business? Let's talk about, there was a 17-year, right, before you went public, that took the business public, you said?
Yeah, about 18 years. Yeah.
So talk about, like, scaling that business. You go from two trucks to what? Like, how does it grow? Tell me what this business looks like at the end of 17 years when you're going public.
Well, that's a good question, Rommel, because, you know, I mean, how do you adopt some vision about how you grow your business? So you're either driven by ambition or you're driven by fear. Maybe there's other things that drives a person, but, you know, I probably had a little bit of both of that. But in my mind, we were either growing or we would fail. If we were not growing the business, I always feared failure.
Grow or die.
Right. So we had some very early successes. I was very creative in my thinking. For example, the Houston Chronicle back then had, you know, delivered proofs, artwork, and tear sheets. They didn't have technology then. This was a hand carryable, and they had like 30 vehicles that worked for them. I talked the Houston Chronicle into get rid of those trucks and then outsourcing the work to me. That was a big win. That was a big win. Exxon Company USA, they had a lot, they had like 2,200 vendors in Houston that they bought from, but they, all the vendors would call the delivery service. And they would prepay and add the cost of that delivery that goes into that the largest refinery in the world, which is in Baytown, Texas, which is right on the east side of Houston. I talked to Exxon and convinced them to consolidate that into one company, mine, and that we could save them money. And we did. We saved them like $3 million in the first year of the program that I had presented to him. It was very innovative. It was a very different way of approaching how do you wrangle with costs that are not in your control. And I showed them how it could be in their control. So Exxon, Houston Chronicle, Houston Post, which followed what the Chronicle did. These were early wins at a very early age, at 27 years old.
Wow.
You know, I went from having no money. But in the first year that I acquired our little business that we started from the gentleman that I told you about, we were making a 22% bottom line, you know, sales of $3.2 million. So $600,000 at that in your 20s, late 20s, yeah, it was life changing. And having that that capital, or having that those profits, was scary. And, you know, because money comes into your fingers and it leaves it pretty quickly if you're not careful.
That's right.
So, you know, I never had any money. I didn't know how to spend money. I just left it in the bank and let it, and I didn't think about it. And so when we had a big downturn in Houston, which was in 84, Reed Rockbit, a good customer, might be shipping 50 deliveries a day, dropped to 5. You know, this is universal in Houston. It was a huge downturn. I'd never experienced that cycle in my business career. I just thought it was always uphill, right? I mean, the line was going up, right?
That's right.
And it went down. But what I had, the saving grace was, I had money in the bank, and I saved my money. And so I was able to take that money and purchase other delivery services that were struggling throughout Texas and Louisiana. And so I would buy them, and I'd retain the owner, and they would become my partner. And we worked very, very well together. And so that's the way we grew our business, not only organic growth, but also through acquisitions. That was very important, because when the economy came back, then you had this multiplier effect of revenues and profits. And so that was the way, and then we had ups and downs in the economy, but over 18 years, it was just, you know, keep your eyes focused on, you know, going to work, grabbing the bull by the horn every single day, and then providing great service to your customers, and keeping your nose clean, don't get stupid with your personal life,
you know.
and then get up the next day and do it again.
Got it. So you roll up these other businesses, you acquire these companies. How many did you acquire over that 18-year time? Do you remember the number of companies?
Yeah, you know, at that point, it's probably around 6 or 7.
Okay.
They have small acquisitions.
Got it.
But when I had a partner, and we made a really fateful decision to embark upon this idea of putting together a roll-up strategy in our industry. And that was like in year 18, coupled with an IPO on the New York Stock Exchange. Very risky maneuver. I was naive. I didn't understand the risk. All I saw was the opportunity for growing the business, and I was always growth oriented. This was a great idea that was brought to me by a gentleman by the name of Mike Baker. And I said, I want to do that. And we did do that. 9 months later, I was standing on the New York Stock Exchange floor watching U.S. delivery stock being traded. It traded up, which was a good sign. We went out at $10 a share. The other 6 delivery companies that joined with me and me with them, those business owners asked me to manage the acquisition program, which that we were an acquisition company, really. And so so with all the work that I had done on the MCAA board of directors and government affairs, I got to know a lot of delivery service owners around the country. And so I took on that responsibility and bought, I think the number was 73 companies in about 30 months. And we boosted our revenues from, I think we were about $100 million when we went public. And then 30 months later, we were at $910 million, nearly a billion.
How does that, you said 910
million.
Million. Amazing, first of all. How does that change your life once you IPO? Because that's like a business step that not a lot of people have an opportunity to kind of do, right? So tell me a little bit about that. When you IPO and you know, you're on the stock exchange now, you said you guys were at $10 a share?
Yeah.
Like, what is that like? How does that change from a business owner's perspective? Now you have a fiduciary responsibility to investors and so forth and so on. Like, the business kind of changes, right? Can you tell me about that?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, it does not. But you're operating in a very different, legal arena, right? You now have responsibilities that require SEC meeting SEC rules and regulations and reporting and so on and so forth. So, you know, and our group of men and owners, we did not have that experience, but we were smart enough to find a group of a couple of guys that had that experience, and we brought them in, and we subjected our positions. I mean, we were all kings in our own kingdom, right?
Right.
All entrepreneurs and very successful guys. I say relative, you know, it's all relative. But we brought in an experienced a man who we asked him to serve as our CEO, and we subjected ourselves to his management style and so on and so forth. But it was very collaborative, and he was the right man for the job. And he had great experience on Wall Street. And so we worked together to operate in that public environment. So when we had our initial public offering, we raised about $35 to $40 million at the IPO. And then our plan was to consolidate, you know, this highly fragmented industry. Mm. And so that was our purpose. It excited investors, institutional investors on Wall Street. They liked our plan. They liked our business model, and they invested in our offering. You know, our offering, our issue was pre-bought. You know, we had hoped to come out at between $12 and $14 a share. We came out at $10. We took a little discount, but we felt that was okay. And then off we went. And so we had really good experience in operating in a public environment. We had really good experience because we knew the industry and the industry business owners. And so we could go into a town, or I could go into a town and have 5 visitations with 5 delivery service owners, walk through the door, get a lay of the land, find out, you know, you can see a quality company by just walking through the door. hey, you can find a quality company by checking their bathroom out. How clean was their bathroom, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, I'd go in and I began the work and you know, began to stack up experience and, you know, acquiring these businesses. And they were, for the most part, really good acquisitions, really great entrepreneurs, really excited about what we were doing, wanted to be a part of it. And they also really liked the value that we brought, because they could magnify the value of their businesses by selling to us on a stock for stock basis and see if the stock was growing. And our stock did grow. We went from $10 a share, and 30 months later we sold for $36.50 a share.
Wow.
So the business owners that sold their businesses to U.S. Delivery Systems, for the most part, did very, very well. There were a few stinkers.
Got it. Now, were all the businesses that you acquired all same day delivery, or did you do any like adjacent businesses that were, you know, in the industry but not the actual, you know, same day delivery? Like, tell me about that, your acquisition strategy.
Well, great question, Rommel. Because you can just have the basic strategy of consolidating the industry and buying all these companies, and then what do you have? You have a big mess if you can't, you know, properly integrate those businesses, properly brand it, and then leverage, you know, the power of a national pickup and delivery platform. And it was very chaotic. But just in buying the same day express delivery businesses across the country, having done that, the next thing we need to do is to connect the cities. So then, you know, it was a different vertical in our an adjacent. I like the way you said that. It's an adjacent kind of business. So we began to acquire companies with bigger trucks that was moving cargo from Chicago to St. Louis, or Chicago, St. Louis to Houston, you know, and they just come down the center, stop off in Oklahoma City, Dallas, Houston. And so you kind of can take this middle of America if you connect the cities with trucking operations. We began to buy companies that did that. There's a company known as Forward Air. They have, you know, really they're the big company that has done very well in this area. So in 1994, we were just trying to put that together, you know. And so we did have adjacent acquisition strategies or different verticals that we were going after. But before we could really get everything integrated and fully formed, we had an unsolicited offer from Corporate Express at $36.50 a share. Our board of directors, my partners, we got together and we were like, heck yeah. You know, I was like, do we even have to talk about this? So we decided we would sell the Corporate Express.
Got it. So you sold the Corporate Express for $36 a share. So you guys exit at that point?
No, we remained and continued with the work that we were doing.
Okay.
I decided after about a year I would leave U.S. Delivery. I had an offer to join Notre Capital. And what we did at U.S. Delivery and consolidating this very interesting, highly fragmented industry, there's other industries that have the markings like U.S. Delivery.
Right.
Whether it was in HVAC, which we at Notre Capital, we created Comfort Systems USA. It's still traded on the New York Stock Exchange. It's a very, very well-run HVAC plan, design, build business. We looked at the motor coach business. We created Coach USA. I don't know if you've seen the motor coaches with the big C, Coach USA.
I'm familiar with Coach USA. Yes,
so,
sir.
And Notre Capital, my partner and I, we... primarily on my partner's side, he that was his focus, you know. So we did, and you know, manufactured housing. We did Homes USA. We did Specialty Metals. We did Metals USA. So these were roll ups in highly fragmented industries where we wanted to create the dominant player, and we would finance it through a public offering. And so we did a number of those things, and I did that for a time in the late 90s. And I was doing a roll-up in the intermodal transportation industry, that sector, and a company called Roadlink USA. And I was successful in getting that financed. But I didn't take it public. I did a private deal, put in my own capital, and then also GE Capital was my financing partner. And we did a roll-up creating Roadlink USA. Today, Roadlink is known as Road One.
Familiar with that.
And so we sold Roadlink USA to Fenway Partners in 2006, I believe. And so I was chairman and chief executive officer of Roadlink USA. Then I became non-executive chairman, and then we sold the business to Fenway. In the meantime, I got back into the same-day express delivery business with my two sons, Josh and Matthew, who are my partners today. And that little business we bought in 1998 is a thriving trucking company called Pinch Transport. Offices, I think, in 11 or 12 cities, focused in the oil and gas, energy business, flatbed, intermodal, and third-party logistics providers. So that's Pinch Transport, which still, you know, I serve as chairman of that company.
Yeah, I love it. I'm just thinking through, you know, the different industries that you guys would venture into. Like you said, everything from like HVAC to just, you saw something in these industries, and that's why you decided to kind of get into them. What was a common thread in all those industries that made you want to invest in them?
Well, similar to my experience at U.S. Delivery, these are industries that are highly fragmented, chock full of very innovative or very hardworking entrepreneurs doing very well in their respective cities where they were plying their trades. But they were fragmented. And through my acquisition experience at U.S. Delivery, I really got to know the business owner's mind and where they are in their life journey. And, you know, how old they are, what's going on in their families. Do they have family members in the business, brothers or sisters, aunts and uncles? And I began to see a pattern where a business owner who's been in business, let's say, for 20 years, like I was, and they want something different out of their life. They want to maybe take a different approach to a business life, or maybe they want to have a liquidity event, and they want to retire. So I began to see patterns in these business owners in these fragmented industries, whether it's Coach USA or Roadlink USA or Homes USA or U.S. Delivery, and I really got a chance to understand. I could talk to a man, ask some questions, and figure out, is he someone that wants something different in life? And so we can have a meaningful conversation about acquiring his business, and we can go from there. So I had a stint in my career where those roll-ups were very successful, but then, you know, things change, things pass. And there was an interesting time in the 90s where...
All right, guys, Truck and Hustle has now partnered with Transpo CFO, powered by Venning. Transpo CFO offers a streamlined monthly subscription for businesses to consolidate their accounting, payroll, and tax needs into one flat monthly rate, saving businesses a tremendous amount of time and money while making their financial operations much smoother for the long road ahead. Check out Transpo CFO in the description below and tell them Truck and Hustle sent you. Now let's get back to the show.
The FASB rules, the accounting rules, allowed for you to acquire businesses, not have to book goodwill. You could restate earnings. And so basically you could engineer your earnings. You could literally, through your acquisition program, you know, make sure that you're going to meet the quarterly expectations that are set on in the public markets. Those rules changed. At the same time, .com was breaking on the scene. People were not interested in roll-ups. The institutional investors were tired of that. There were some stinkers, actually. We had a very good, pretty good success record at Notre Capital. But I went back to my roots, which was transportation with Roadlink USA. And I really liked the intermodal business. And I learned a lot about how to move cargo, you know, by truck, by train, by ship, you know, and how all that is knitted together more from a global perspective, you know, and how, you know, how ships connect with trains, connects with trucks, connects with warehouses. And that kind of was a very important education for me to kind of think differently about transportation, you know, from a lot of different perspectives. And helped me become a more of a creative thinker about solutions for delivery, you know, and Roadlink USA played very heavily in our disruption of the frac sand supply chain, which is a whole different, you know, kind of a story, but a very interesting one at that.
Yeah, as an investor outside of, you know, obviously money, what additional value do you bring to these businesses? Like when you acquire businesses, what's the value add?
So, you know, everybody can be an investor. I say everybody, you know, to some degree or another. But it's, what do you do with your money, right? I mean, how do you manage, you know, your investment? In my world, it's I'm an owner operator. I look at myself as, you know, maybe I might be a lead investor or be a minor investor, but I want to follow my investment, and so I want to be involved in the business. I want to add, you know, what experience that I have, and so I want to make the investment. I want to sit on top of my investment. You know, I want to follow it, and I want to help the business owners, and you know, are the executive team in starting up a business. Overcoming all the obstacles that are associated with startups, which are very difficult, very, very hard to do, and help them get over the hump and establish a stable, thriving business. So investment, owner, operator. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. What does a good investment look like to you when you know that it's not a stinker? What is the opposite of a stinker? When you see these trends or you see, you know, this on your P&Ls, like what are the things that you're looking for to say, hey, this is a good investment?
Well,
and that can be a vague question, but yeah, Still it as much as you can.
Well, you can look at it from different perspectives. I mean, you know, private equity, you know, they've got their formulas for, you know, if they're going to make an equity investment, they want to make sure that their return on investment or return on equity, you know, are certain percentages, and call it, you know, 23% plus, you know, a very that's sort of a stable expectation. But then you can also have these big winners, right, where you can have a 5x. I'll put it to you in baseball terms. You can have a first base kind of a return, or second base, or you can have a home run return.
That's right.
So, you know, you can get your, you know, you can basically get your basics, you know, a two bagger, you know, maybe a three bagger. Occasionally you want that four bagger, you want that home run, and then it will really improve your overall investment. It'll bring your total return on investment up, but you want to invest in multiple opportunities. So there's the private equity sort of a viewpoint, but then there's the individual. So we're all looking for the four bagger, right? So in my case, it's a matter of trying to understand the risk involved, understanding, and I operate sort of like in the rule of twos. So anything I think about that I'm going to do is probably going to cost me twice as much as I think it's going to cost me. It's going to be twice as hard as whatever I might project, and it's going to take me twice as long. And Tuya Technologies, for example, is a very good example of living the rule of twos. It has been twice as hard. It has been twice as long, and it has been twice as expensive.
What would you say is your worst investment, if you could come off the top of your head, that was just a terrible idea, should have never did it?
Well, that's a problem, Rommel, because and here's the problem, and I'm gonna throw you a curve here.
Yeah.
Look, as I said earlier, I had some very early successes in my late 20s, which sort of skews your thought process about winning and losing, right? You win, you're a winner, right? And then you work and you make good profits, and then you magnify that through a maneuver, like a really risky maneuver of taking your company public. That was great. And then you come off of that and you do these roll, and this is great. And then you go into road, and that's great. And then so if you have a lifetime of greats, you know, your head gets screwed
that's
up.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
And so I think the hardest thing that I've done, I think the most creative thing I've done is to invent the way frac sand is delivered downhole. That was the greatest and the most innovative and fun that I had with my eldest son, Josh, is a co-creator and co-inventor. Josh likes to say that I came up with the idea and he made it work. I have to agree with that.
Okay. Yeah.
But between Josh and I, we had like 65 patents, and we completely disrupted the frac sand supply chain. We really upset some big majors in completely changing the way that process works. Well, I mean, we invented rail cars that was, you know, certified by first class railroads. We invented, you know, chassis that had never been when I talked to chassis manufacturers about being able to handle 55,000 pounds in an 8-foot by 10-foot footprint, they said that's impossible. You can't do that. It's going to break. Particularly on the harsh roads of a ranch where you're going through big bumps, and you couldn't. It was impossible. But we invented it and we built it, and it works. At Sandbox Logistics, that was the company that was commercialized all of our inventions, and we didn't realize it. You know, we had our goals of which was being able to deliver a box of 48,000 pounds of frac sand in a matter of 2 minutes, which it would take over an hour with a pneumatic truck. We thought that was the big deal. That wasn't the big deal. The big deal was that we could deliver frac sand faster than the completions company could consume the sand. We could keep them, and they would not have to shut down their equipment to get reloaded on frac sand. Our box idea was like putting bullets in a 45. We just put the bullets on, and they could continue to frack a well. What we learned is that our process broke through a very important bottleneck, and they could frack a well in half the time. So if completion company are charging $400,000 an hour to frack a well, if you can cut that a 10-day frack job into 5 days, that is a very important thing. And I think it's very gratifying that my son and I were able to figure out how to break through that bottleneck, eliminate the threat of silica dust that people were breathing, cut down the noise, and we thought that was the deal. We didn't realize that there could be this breakthrough on the production side for the completions company. That made that company very valuable, and it made our investors, you know, realize a four bagger, you know, if you'd say so. So that was fun. It was creative, and it was very healthy. It was very helpful to the industry. That was great. Coming off of that success and all these other successes, you know, you get spoiled in your mind. You say, I can do anything. And so I was an owner in a software provider, a company called DataTrack. DataTrack provides operating systems for this same-day express delivery industry, and they've been in business since the late 70s as well. Through my ownership of that really terrific company, and having been away from the industry for a while, I asked my partner, well, what are we going to do with DataTrack? What should we do with the business? And he goes, well, it's going along pretty well. I said, well, I'm going to go talk to delivery service owners. And so I started in Seattle, and I had 3 or 4 appointments. Then I moved to Portland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego. Then I went to Boston, worked my way down to Miami, Chicago, down the middle, St. Louis, Atlanta, so on and so forth. Over a summer, I talked to over 100 delivery service owners. This 7 years ago. When I talked about threats, what did they see as a threat? The big talk then was Uber. Mm. And the way Uber completely upended and disrupted the taxi industry. And there's similarities between the taxi cab business and the same-day express delivery business. And so business owners were afraid that all this money that Uber was attracting could be, you know, those guns could be turned to our industry.
That's right.
And so there was big talk about that. And that was the big talk when I talked to business owners, that there was a fear that disruption could occur. I went back, talked to my partner at DataTrack, and I said, we need to build this technology. And I said, we're going to do that. And we're going to invest, and we're going to build this marketplace platform, and we're going to digitize everything that goes on inside the four walls of a delivery service. This marketplace platform is the future. And so we began to build the technology. We raised capital. We put in our own money, all that stuff. And so the point of the story is this. This is really hard. This has been kicking my ass.
You know? Right, right.
I mean, to tell you, and my son, both of them, actually, Josh and Matthew, they go like, Dad, what are you doing? You do not know anything about technology. I wouldn't listen, you know? I was so arrogant in my thinking that, you know, I can do this too. And so, you know, I took it on. And, you know, we've raised a pretty good amount of money, and we've blown through it all. And, you know, we're surviving. COVID had a tremendous negative effect on our plans. But this has been hard. And so when you say a stinker, you know, I think the story is still out. We can be tremendously successful. I mean, another platform, Roadie. Roadie sold to UPS.
Yeah, familiar with them.
Roadie was not profitable when they sold. To UPS. UPS paid a tremendous price. I think it was private, but probably around $500 million plus shipped, sold to Target. Everybody's trying to get into this platform, a digital platform, marketplace platform segment, the new technology stack. So the way Uber moved people to your technologies moves parcels, pallets, and packages, right? The same way. Connecting a shipper directly with a shipper who says, I need something delivered, with somebody who says, I have a truck and I want to do delivery work.
Yeah.
And our technology connects the two, right? And take care of all of the other things that need to be considered in moving cargo and under Department of Transportation rules and regulations, insurance, background checks, and so on and so forth. So the point is that this is a serious effort in building the technology stack. It is not something that I should have thought I could do.
Right.
But we've done it, right? And I have to give a lot of credit to our IT Vice President of Information Technology, Jay Costales, and the rest of the team that I put together to help get us through, you know, the startup phase, seed capital, VC, and the different rounds, and get it properly financed, get our business plan together, bring in an executive team to get it done. I serve as CEO of Tuya Technologies. And so, but it's been really, really hard. And there have been times like I'm wondering if we're going to make it, right?
I'm curious, where is the bottleneck? Is it just adoption? Because it's like, this is a marketplace, you said, right? Between shippers and, like you said, people who would, you know, offer these services, who are already out there doing it, right, for other companies. So where do you think is the bottleneck, and where do you find the trouble in getting this people to adopt this technology?
Well, the technology is being adopted.
Okay.
Look at Roadie.
Right.
Look at Shipt.
Right.
Right. Look at Amazon and you know what they're doing, the phenomenal things that they're doing. So this will happen, and it is happening.
Right.
People would ask me, why do you think you could compete with Uber or DoorDash or Roadie or others? There's a lot of room, right, in this space. You know, our approach to launching new technology is different. It's a different approach, which acquisitions play a very important role in our business model. So we want to acquire delivery services in the top 25 cities. We want to have a traditional business in each of the cities. And then we have a process by which we follow to launched the technology. So it market adoption of just a pure marketplace platform is very expensive. If you just go at it and you know, in trying to maintain balance on the platform between supply and demand, you know, you can have you can offer shippers lower prices, and you can offer drivers higher pay, and then you can pay for, you know, the market adoption. We don't have that kind of money, so we want to deploy our capital through buying traditional businesses, creating the national pickup and delivery capability, layering our technology on top of an existing operation. And what we want to do is we want to build value in an innovative company that is tech-enabled. Mm. And the end result is that we believe that, you know, companies will pay a much higher price for that business as opposed to a traditional delivery business that will have some multiple of EBITDA, right? Call it 5 or 6, tech-enabled, maybe 16, 17, 18. So, you know, that's kind of the fundamental idea I had. Build the technology, create the national pickup and delivery capability, layer the technology on top of it. Somebody will want that.
So you have like the supply already kind of built in to where like you already have these companies that you're acquiring, they're already there.
Yes, right? They're already there.
It makes a lot of sense. Okay. All right, cool. So right now, what is that your primary focus right now? The Tuya Technologies, is that like what keeps you up at night?
It is what keeps me up at night.
Okay.
And I focus all of my time on Tuya Technologies and the traditional delivery business that we bought 5 companies in Texas. We've proven out everything in Texas. You know, our acquisition strategy, our financial structure, you know, how we're going to launch, so on and so forth. All that's done in Texas. We operate in Houston, Austin, Dallas, San Antonio, and El Paso. So we're in a very friendly state, a business-friendly state, shaking it all out, proving it all up, and getting through COVID, which had a very negative effect on our business, and you know, put us, you know, in dire straits, you know, because we're burning massive amounts of capital, you know, leading up to COVID. We were going to do our 4th round, raise our $50 million round to finish off our acquisition program. COVID just sort of disrupted everything. Mm-hmm. So we've been biding our time, building our traditional business, getting it to pay for everything, and then go from there.
Got it. Now, I want to respect your time because I know you got to catch a flight. So we're going to kind of keep this short and kind of begin to wrap, because I could literally talk to you all day about this stuff because you have so much different moving parts and things going on. Just high level, as an investor, I guess, what is the biggest lesson that you've learned over the last, man, what has it been, 30, 40 years? I mean, you've been doing this for quite a while. I mean, entrepreneurship and then investing for probably half of that. What's some of the biggest takeaways or some of the biggest lessons that you've learned that you could share with our audience?
Well, the biggest lesson I've learned is that when your wife says you're spending too much money on an investment, you ought to listen.
I like that.
That's a pretty good litmus test, I will tell you. If she says, do not put another nickel into that company, or I'm going to kill you.
That's right.
Right. So that's not, it's funny, but it's true. Right.
Yeah.
You know, you don't overextend. Don't gamble with grocery money.
Got it. All right. So traditionally on this show, we always have to have a final thought, right? So one before we go, I want you to let everybody know where they connect with you and learn more about Tuya, since that's the baby and that's kind of what you're working on nurturing right now.
Mm-hmm.
I love people to get involved in that in any way they can. And then secondly, where they can connect with you personally. And then lastly, man, just leave us with a entrepreneurial word, man, just some sort of encouragement for the people kind of listening to this show right now. So first, where can people learn more about Tuya Technologies and also connect with you?
Go to tuyatech.com. You can find me there, and there's a video. I'm a little embarrassed about it, but you know,
you need us to reshoot it for you. We can hook you up.
Oh yeah, really? It probably needs it. But you can find me there at tuyatech.com. What was the
final thought?
Oh, the final thought. All right, I'm going to tell you. When we sold Sandbox Logistics, and I had my executive team and my son, who was the CEO, and we were celebrating, you know, the liquidity event. We sold Sandbox Logistics to U.S. Silica, a stock-for-stock deal. It was fabulous, fabulous event. And we were taking time around the table, and I was asking each of the executives, you know, what they thought and how they felt and an opinion. And so everybody had their say, and it was just a conversation. But my son, he said, "Well, Dad, let me give an opinion about you." And I'm like, "Oh, well, what, you know?" Because he's my most vociferous critic, you know. He said, "One thing about you is you're fearless. And that really sunk into me. Fearless. Don't be afraid of your ideas. You know, if you got an idea and you really, you know, and you do your homework, you don't be foolish about an idea, but vet your idea, talk to people that are you respect, get your information, and then you make a decision and go into it, go all into it. And don't be afraid about what the consequences are. You never know, you know, how it might wind up. You have your ideas, you got your plans, you got your forecast, you work in it and all that. But there, all kinds of things, good things can happen by living that dream."
Man, I love it. Mr. John Oren, investor, Tuya Technologies, Pinch Logistics, that's the other one?
Pinch Transport.
Pinch Transport. So many businesses to name. Like I said, we could talk all day. I'd love to maybe revisit this at some time and talk about where Tuya is at in a sure. year or two. I think that would be really cool to kind of sure. revisit this conversation. But I thank you so much for sitting down with
thank
me
you.
And taking your very valuable time, man. Hustle fam, you know what we do around this time. If you don't respect that, your whole perspective is whack. If you smell something burning, it's only your desire. Mr. John Oren is a perfect case study of that. Thank you, John. I appreciate everything, man.
Thank you, Rommel. It's been a pleasure.
All right, sir. Take care. Hustle fam, we are out.
If you twisted, confused, or stuck about trucks, don't be dumb. This is the place to come. Truck and Hustle. Let's go!